Honourable Bob McMillan, who's here just simply because he's such an admirer of mine. He's really come to my session, as he said. Bob, you wish to know that John Anderson, in his circle of remarks, recognised you as an arriving member of this group. Consistent with the bipartisan support we've had from both the Coalition and the Labour Party for investment in international agricultural research, long may it last. We've got three speakers: Andrew Campbell, Brian Allen, and Professor Tom Compass. I'm going to ask Andrew to speak first.
Thanks very much, Dennis. It's a great pleasure to be here, Tom. I was delighted to see the topic of this event. Well, it took me a while to get the Security Cubed title.
Security quadrupled.
But I've been talking about what I call the converging insecurities for a decade or so of climate, water, energy, and food. And last week at the ANU at the Crawford School, there was a forum with the chief scientists of Australia, New Zealand, the UK, current and former chief scientists of Australia. But John Beddington said that we need to be thinking about climate as a risk multiplier. And that's how he characterised climate change across those. It's a big risk issue in its own right, but it multiplies and amplifies those other risks. And for us in the agricultural research world, food security is not as straightforward as it used to be, if it ever was. It's no longer good enough for us to just grow more food, but thinking about nutrition and equity for the distribution of, and as Julie said before, we've got not just the double burden, but the triple burden questions. So, and those equity dimensions of how food's distributed, and in particular, the gender question, if we can empower women and girls and give them access to the same resources, the data's pretty clear that we can get a system-wide lift in all sorts of outcomes. So I wanted to zoom in on the nexus questions. I think these nexus questions are going to dominate this century in science, policy, industry, and civil society. It's not good enough for us just to be to fix one element of the system. Generally, we find then that other things are adversely affected. And I've been looking at resilience, the resilience literature, which I found to be rather impenetrable at times, and I'm not sure how to operationalise some of it, but nevertheless, I think there are some useful insights in there, in particular the notion of subsidiarity in governance and leadership. That you should be trying to make decisions at the lowest practicable level in the system. The notion of, and I think, as we alluded to before lunch, question of leadership globally, at national levels, and at all levels is critically important. To see this dreadful energy policy debate in Australia, I think if we wait for national leadership to solve that, we could be waiting a very long time. But if you look and see what some local councils are doing, you look and see what some cities are doing, you look and see what towns like Hepburn are doing or Yackandandah, you can actually see some solutions. And so leadership at all levels is going to be crucial. The resilience literature tells you to take a careful look at reservoirs. Reservoirs like memory, like community knowledge and wisdom, like old people and youth, like seed and soil nutrients, like aquifers, the things that give you buffer against big events and the things that help you to recover from them. And I think if we can take some of that thinking into the way in which we think about bureaucracies and institutions and the sharing of knowledge and ideas, as His Excellency mentioned before lunch, that's going to be really important. So, for me, how we do science is a really important question. Reductionism still has a place, but it needs to be nested in ways of doing science that enable you to come up and have analytical tools that can operate at higher levels across a bunch of different issues. We still need microscopes, but we need to complement the microscopes with some macroscopes that enable us to look at how these things intersect and amplify. Some of those interactions are synergistic, some of them are antagonistic, and we need to understand the way in which they work. Some of the trade-offs are unavoidable, and in other cases, with clever thinking, you can turn trade-offs into potential win-wins. So I'm only new at ACR, joined a wonderful organisation that's been around for 35 years, and we didn't pay Dennis for his bouquet before lunch, but it's gratefully received. But we're developing a new 10-year strategy for ACR, a high-level document, about 10 pages. To use a Ruddism, it won't have any programmatic specificity, but it will set out the high-level direction that we're going. And I was confronted when I started at ACR with the fact that I had 12 programs and 12 research program managers that looked like a 1980s ag department. Crop production, crop health, animal production, animal health, fisheries, forestry, horticulture, and so on. And the minister's priorities were gender, climate, nutrition, value chains, private sector engagement. I didn't have a single person with anything in their title that matched the minister's priorities. And so the minister's operating in rows and we're organised in columns. How do we get a portfolio that better addresses the big public policy priorities, which I think are not ephemeral, they're not just fads, these things are going to be with us for a long time, without losing disciplinary rigour and strength? We don't want to become a fuzzy, woolly outfit that is operating so horizontally that there's no penetration in depth anymore. In the Pacific, we've got a portfolio of around, and I looked at the map very carefully. Our Pacific investment is overwhelmingly Melanesian. We have about a $20 million portfolio of about 60 projects. I would think we'll be looking at fewer, bigger, better integrated, longer term projects over time. And as the Minister has made clear to us, 80% of all our work needs to have a strong gender component. Wherever possible, we should be trying to work down the value chain and engage the private sector. And so we'll be looking at projects that in effect are more like programs. And I'm very keen that we better integrate our capacity building work. So at the moment we invest about $10 million a year on primarily on PhD scholarships. I was astonished the other day to be asked to sign off on 30 PhD scholarships worth $360,000 each. So if there's a better gig around than that, I'd like to know what it is. So they're wonderful scholarships that are absolutely transformative for the people who get them from our partner countries. But I think sometimes we'd be better off investing in growing institutional capability, not just in individuals. And so we're looking at how we can get a better mix of capability building. We provide core funding to SPC of about $500,000 a year. We fund a twinning arrangement between the University of the South Pacific and, we put a call out to all Australian universities, and Sunshine Coast University won the tender to provide long-term partnering with the University of the South Pacific on curriculum development, staff training, staff exchanges, and master's scholarships for about 26 master's students a year to get plugged into ACR projects in the region. So we're trying very hard to build long-term capability in the region, but Your Excellency, your comments before about how we share knowledge and how we build networks that are sustaining, I think are highly pertinent. And so we're looking at cranking up a much better alumni network of anyone who's ever been engaged in any of our projects. And in days where, someone can change markets with a tweet, we have amazing technologies to share information these days, and we need to be employing all of those in the way in which we have a network grappling with these big, complex, long-term problems. So I look forward to working with a lot of the people in this room on this challenge over the next few years. We'd like to think that our partnership model of working always closely in partnership with agencies in the civil society sector, the industry sector and the government sector in our partner countries is a robust one. And we would hope that over the long term we're able to jointly look at some of these very complex issues. But sometimes I think that Australia could make a better contribution in the region if we just got our act together at home. I don't think we're paragons in this area of the integration of climate, water, energy and food domestically, let alone internationally. So there's a big job for us to be doing here as well as overseas. So we're on this journey with you. It's not as if there's some magic bullet here that just needs to be miraculously transplanted somewhere else. These are complex questions that we're all grappling with, and we will be for the rest of this century, in my view. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Brian Allen, who's Honorary Associate Professor, State Society and Governance and Melanesia Program at the ANU College of Asian and Pacific. Brian, you've got 10 minutes. We're starting.
Jeff? I'm not going to talk to them, they just give us questions. Okay. Thanks very much. Because I have only 10 minutes to talk about three countries, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, I'm just going to talk about Papua New Guinea. Much of what I say about Papua New Guinea can be applied to the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, but I would observe that Papua New Guinea has 13 times the population of Solomon Islands and 28 times the population of Vanuatu. I want to argue that one of the greatest security concerns for Papua New Guinea is the rate of population increase and the long-term threat that it presents to food security and political stability. Other concerns include a national land grab, global climate change, and a failure of quarantine. We've now got coffee leaf rust and pogo pod borer in Papua New Guinea that wasn't there 30 years ago. First, let me say briefly something about New Guinea's population. In 1980, the population of Papua New Guinea was 3.13 million. It's now estimated to be 7.32, and Mike Burke would argue that it's 8 million at least. The population in Papua New Guinea is doubling every 30 years. So all other things being equal, by 2050 it'll be around 15 million people. And that's frightening enough, but at least 7 million of those 15 million will be under the age of 15. That rate of population increase impacts on a broad range of development efforts, but I want to talk about food production and to explain how a rapidly growing population poses a threat to food security. First, some facts about the PNG population. It is overwhelmingly rural. 81% live in rural areas in 2000. 6% in rural non-village, so that's 87% are actually in rural areas. Rural non-village locations like missions and patrol posts and so on. Only 13% live in the towns. Half of the rural population lives below 600 metres above sea level, that's in the lowlands. 40% live between 1,200 and 2,400 metres, that's in the highlands. Another 14% live above 1,800 metres in high altitude areas, and 7% live between 600 and 1,200 metres, which is commonly called the highlands fringe. Now, some facts about land and food crops. A very important matter, frequently overlooked or ignored, thanks, is that PNG does not have a large areas of high quality land waiting to be occupied by a growing population. An analysis of the quality of land, done by Mike Burke and others, measured by how well that grain would grow sweet potato, and we'll see why sweet potato was important before, but it's an easy crop to use to do these sorts of analyses. That analysis found that more than 70% of the total land area of Papua New Guinea is low or very low quality land. It's either too high, too wet, too steep, or floods every now and again. But most of that land, most of Papua New Guinea, is not used for population, and the yellow there is not cultivated. The green areas are land that has been cultivated in the past using shifting cultivation systems. So not all of that green area gets cultivated at once, but it has been used in the past. That's from CSIRO. Should just put in a plug for CSIRO. From 1950 to 1970, carried out large numbers of resource surveys in Papua New Guinea, put it all together into a GIS, which is just sitting there unused at the moment. Seventy percent of rural people, however, produce food from moderate or low quality land. Only 20% of the population produce food from high quality land, and the high quality land is associated with high population densities. The great majority of people in rural Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu as well feed themselves. In 2006, Mike Burke estimated that 83% of the food energy and 76% of the protein consumed in Papua New Guinea was produced in Papua New Guinea. Now, in urban areas, only 50% of the food energy was produced in Papua New Guinea. So most of the imported food goes to cities and towns, and that's where it is very important. All right, what are the staple foods? Well, sweet potato provides over 65% of the food energy. Bananas 8%, two species of taro 8%, sago 7%, cassava 6%, yams 5%. So root crops are 84% of the food energy consumed in Papua New Guinea. Of these staples, three, sweet potato, one species of taro and cassava, have been introduced into PNG from South America since 1700 or around then. Although an African yam has recently been successfully introduced, there are no new species or varieties of existing species waiting to provide PNG with a green revolution in the future. Rice production is increasing but remains way below the amount of food provided from root crops. Rice production is politically very popular but faces a number of environmental problems at the moment. So let me summarise these facts about PNG populations and land and food production. The population is growing at around 2.5% per year, and at this rate will double in the next 30 years. PNG is a root crop country and is unlikely to become a grain crop country in the foreseeable future. PNG does not have large areas of unused land that a growing population can expand agriculture onto. Around 80% of the food energy and a slightly lower proportion of protein is produced from within Papua New Guinea. Imported foods are important in towns and in rural areas as a supplement to even out fluctuations in supply caused by environmental like the droughts. We'll talk about them in a minute. Now I want to talk about how these staple foods are produced, because this is where it gets interesting. With the exception of sago, all PNG foods are produced from farming systems that do not use fertilizers. Soil fertility is maintained by using short periods of cultivation and dispersed with long periods of fallow or unused when the land is left uncultivated. Even highland systems, where cultivation periods are as long as 20 years, move whole areas of crops from one area to another every now and again. Cultivated areas are moved for three main reasons: because the crops draw chemical nutrients from the soil, and after a number of plantings, the food crops don't produce satisfactorily. Because during cultivation, the soil is exposed to strong sunshine and heavy rain, and it leaches and otherwise destroys the soil nutrients. And because pests and diseases increase over time. When a cultivated area is no longer cultivated because the crops have been moved onto a new area, a succession of natural plants occupy the land. If the land was cleared from secondary forest before the cultivation, and if the fallow is long enough, the plant successions will eventually reach a tall secondary forest stage again. In many parts of lowland Papua New Guinea, that may take up to 30 years. And obviously, you can understand that environmental conditions determine the rates at which those successions proceed. So, for example, in Marprick, you go into a grass phase, then a low tree phase, then tall trees. If you go to Bedang, with this twice the rainfall, you go straight into a forest fallow. If the fallow is long enough, the soil nutrients will reach the level they were at before the soils were cultivated. If they do not reach the level they were at before cultivation, and the fallow is not long enough to sustain the system. It may take a number of cycles, and they can be 15 to 25 year cycles, before the soil nutrients reach a critical level and food plants will no longer produce satisfactorily. A number of environmental and cultural factors will determine how long a fallow needs to be for the system to be sustainable. The reason why so much of food production in Papua New Guinea is able to be produced from lower quality land is because the leaf litter cycles and the land cover provided by natural plant successions provide the nutrients used by the food plants. Changes in these fallow plant communities can create problems for food production. In PNG, around 40% of rural people use systems that reach full, tall, secondary forest fallows. And to most people, like you and I, we go into one of those tall forest fallows and it looks like rainforest. It looks like primary forest to us. But to a botanist, it's clearly not. Another 33% use systems that reach a lower forest stage, what we call lower woody regrowth. And then a stage of tall cane grasses in low forest, so scrub and tall grass. The grass is high, you know, it's higher than this root, wild sugar cane. 17% just have a tall grass fallow and 11% a grass fallow. They don't go back to forest at all. Now, we estimate that less than 1% of people in Papua New Guinea clear primary forest. That's forest that's never been used for agriculture before. And that's usually associated with a resettlement scheme or clearing for plantations of some sort. Now, to the question of what happens to shifting cultivation systems when the population doubles in 30 years? If people are not to reduce their nutritional standards, food production must also be doubled every 30 years. PNG shifting cultivators increase food production by increasing the time land is cultivated, so they extend the cultivation period, reducing the time land is left in fallow, finding a more productive food crop species, or a species that will produce on poorer soil. Sweet potato is the outstanding example of that. Adopted in 1700, you will have seen by that earlier slide, now covers three quarters of the country. They plant leguminous or nitrogen-fixing crops with their other crops in rotations, construct barriers to slow soil erosion, till the soil, and ultimately, in some places, incorporate green manure into the soil. If the land is cultivated for longer, so if the cultivation period is extended, the soil is exposed to the elements for longer, and more plantings of crops take out more nutrients. Both practices increase the rate at which nutrients are taken from the system. If the fallow is shortened, the fallow successions will not be able to adequately replace the nutrients before the land is again cleared for cultivation. So in the long term, over a number of cycles, there will be a decline in the nutrients in the system, soil nutrients that is. If this proceeds to the points where crops do not grow satisfactorily, insufficient food will be able to be grown to meet the needs of a growing population. The last survey of food production systems in Papua New Guinea, which was carried out by Mike and I and some other people, funded by AusAid, was completed in 1996, 20 years ago. We now know little about what is happening in rural Papua New Guinea as the population inexorably grows. We can guess what people are doing, from what I have said and from our previous experience and from some recent visit to rural areas. We know, for example, that sweet potato is continuing to become the most important staple in many parts of PNG where it was previously not a staple. We also know that cultivation periods are being extended. So in the village that I first went to in 1971, they planted yam crops twice. They now plant yam crops twice, sweet potatoes three times after that. Population's doubled in that village, food production's doubled, they're not hungry yet. So we know that cultivation periods are being extended, fallow periods are being reduced, but we don't know how this is influencing soil conditions or the broader environment in these areas, nor how it is influencing food production. In the absence of reports of severe malnutrition, we have to assume that so far things have not reached critical levels. But previous child nutrition surveys have shown that the most malnourished children live in the poorest agricultural environments and in the more isolated areas, so we may just not be receiving information about these children. Unless population growth is slowed in Papua New Guinea, the people will gradually become unable to feed themselves as they do now. And I'm not saying it's going to start tomorrow or the next day, could be 50 years' time. If the last two El Nino-induced drought-related food shortages in PNG are any guide to future events, Australian governments will have to take the responsibility, either openly as they did in 1997 or covertly as they did in 2015, or face domestic and international criticism. I say covertly because in 2015 they asked PNG if they wanted help and they said, no, we're fine, thanks. And the minister didn't do anything, perhaps, maybe I'm a cynic, but it might have been something to do with Manus Island. The recent droughts were a short period of crisis, but ultimately parts of Papua New Guinea may become chronically short of food if shifting cultivation systems become unable to produce enough food to feed a growing population. We should be encouraging and assisting PNG to monitor selected rural areas for symptoms of food production systems failing to meet the demands being placed upon them. Thank you.
Tom Compass is going to cheer us all up.
It's good to see old good friends in the audience, and thank you, Dennis, and thank you for the opportunity to talk. Off and on for the last 15 years, I've been working in biosecurity in Australia and throughout the region. Most recently with a group at the University of Melbourne, on leave from ANU at the moment, called the Centre of Excellence for Biosecurity Risk Analysis, which works directly with the Department of Agriculture to implement biosecurity measures. Implement and evaluate from throughout the country up to the Torres Strait. And I've come up with three big lessons in biosecurity to share with you. And I think all are relevant to the Pacific. I have some comments on that. First lesson is that biosecurity agencies, departments, groups focus far too much on emergency response given an incursion, and not enough on prevention or early detection. Most of Biosecurity Queensland's budget in biosecurity at the moment is used to manage white spot for prawns and Panama for bananas. If they hadn't had any emergency funding to go with that, they would have been totally decimated. This is common around the world. Biosecurity focuses on response to an incursion and doesn't try, in fact, to focus on prevention to begin with. Now, by prevention, I mean a number of things, not just strict border quarantine, because things still get through the border. I also and especially mean post-border surveillance, which is quite crucial, trying to detect things early before they spread, multiply, cause additional damages, or spread to such an extent that they actually can't be controlled. Think of red imported fire ants in Queensland. It's a nice example. Still very hard to control. It's important because it's been driven home to me recently because I also work for Chevron, which has a gas facility on Barrow Island. Barrow Island is protected, and part of the arrangement is that with Chevron's activity there, they can't introduce any exotic pest or disease. They have the world's most strict biosecurity border quarantine system, period. Everyone's physically inspected if they arrive on the island. All equipment shrink wrapped. Everything's taken care of, and things still get through. Things still establish. Now, certainly that's true in Australia. Certainly that's true in the Pacific. Many things that are a biosecurity concern in the Pacific are windborne or airborne. Birds and bugs don't stop at a border inspection station. They just go right through. You need post-border surveillance. We've got to try and help biosecurity agencies shift away from responding to an emergency to being more proactive, finding things in the environment early before they cause real damage. That's the first lesson. It's hard to do, but I think we need to help. Australia needs to do this. Our Pacific partners need help in doing this. The second big lesson is that when you're working in biosecurity, when you're running an agency or department, you need to focus on where the value is in the biosecurity system. You can't take the probability of every pest and disease entering a country or a region to zero. It used to be sort of the way in which things were talked about at the Department of Agriculture more than a decade ago. We want to prevent everything from happening. But to take the probability of every pest and disease entering, establishing, and causing trouble to zero would take all of GDP in Australia. You can't do it. So you need to be selective. You need to focus on where you're going to put your activity. That tells you you need to focus on rate of return. Now, that underscores the first point, because I think too much money is spent at the border. That's my general feeling, and I've got some evidence for that, some work that backs that up. Again, I would focus more on post-border surveillance, given the fact that we can't stop everything at the border. We need to shift the balance and focus on things we care about within the system. That doesn't mean, incidentally, we're looking at where the value is, that we put all the money into animal diseases. Not true. In fact, if you do things properly, that's not the right answer. It surprises many of my friends at Animal Health Australia. You know, you need to look at this carefully and find out where the rate of return is. And that's my third big point. When you're thinking about biosecurity and where you're going to invest your money across all the possible pests and diseases you care about, either pre-border, border, post-border management, very difficult set of decisions. When you think about where to put the money, you shouldn't use cost-benefit analysis. I'm an applied mathematician, but also an economist, so this is tough talk, right? Coming from an economist, cost-benefit analysis generally isn't appropriate for this case. You know, it's very common, even in Australia, to do this. People look at what we should invest in by benefit-cost ratios. It's common throughout government. And they tend to put money in areas which have the highest benefit-cost ratio. That ranking is incorrect. You care not about benefits to costs. You care about extra benefits from extra expenditures. You care about the rate of return, not the benefit-cost ratio. I'll give you a little bit of an example here. Queensland comes to SEBRA at the University of Melbourne and asks, should we put in 3,000 traps to try and find papaya fruit fly coming through the Torres Strait pathway early? Should we do that? 3,000 traps. And, we might run a cost-benefit analysis to answer that question. You know, the cost of the trapping system itself wouldn't be hard to estimate or find out. The benefit is the avoided loss from having found something early and preventing it from being spread into horticultural areas in Queensland. You could work up a benefit-cost ratio. It's been done. But that doesn't tell you whether or not you should invest in that for two reasons. Well, maybe it's not 3,000 traps. Maybe it's 1,000 traps or 10,000 traps. There's a serious scale issue here. And benefit-cost ratios are independent of scale. So maybe you want to trap every square kilometer to try and detect things very early and prevent them from spreading. Or maybe it's good enough to have it every square 100 kilometers. The serious question there that benefit-cost analysis isn't going to answer. Because it doesn't answer the question, what's the extra benefit from spending additional amounts? If I go from 1,000 traps to 2,000 traps, I know the extra cost, what's the extra benefit? That's the rate of return. It's not a benefit-cost ratio. And to go with that, the rate of return on traps for papaya fruit fly in Queensland may be lower than some other alternative. Active surveillance measures against FMD, for example, or something else. Control of red imported fire ant. You need to start to think about where the money's going. It surely is relevant for the Pacific, because monies are especially limited. What you're going to control, what you're going to look for, is a difficult calculation, but must be done. So we've done a... How's my time?
You've got 1 minute 30.
And very rigorous timekeeper.
Fantastic. Actually, I've pressed the pause button a few times, so I've been jealous.
Thank you. So we've been doing a lot of work for the Department of Agriculture about this issue of rate of return. And we looked at one recent case we looked at was doing active surveillance for foot and mouth disease. Now you'd think, wow, huge benefit-cost ratio, $40 billion in damages, we better do something about it. better start looking for it early. We compared that to TRAP for papaya fruit fly through the Torres Strait pathway, to red imported fire ant control, to control of hawkweed in the Madgee in Victoria and Tasmania. Okay. Which one do you think has the most investment? It's not FMD. In fact, active surveillance for FMD actually had no return. Most of the investment went into fruit flies and, in fact, hawkweed. Rates of return matter. The extra benefit you get, the reduction in residual risk if you work in this area, from added expenditures is everything. You need to think about where the money goes. And if you do that, don't do a benefit-cost ratio. Inappropriate. Wrong ranking. Dumb. Thank you.
Well, you've had a fair bit there to stimulate discussion on three very, very excellent presentations, but quite diverse. So I'm going to invite, and the speakers have been instructed not to respond to questions straight away, and I've been instructed to encourage you to make comments and observations rather than ask questions. So if you have questions, convert them into comments. Okay, who's going to be first? I'm going to pick someone up, but I don't get a volunteer. Tristan.
My question is...
introduce yourself, please.
My name is Tristan Armstrong. I'm the agriculture and sector specialist at DFAT. I work with Fiona and Julie, who was here earlier. I found all three talks very, very interesting indeed and raised a lot of questions and stimulated a lot of ideas for me. My question I'll pick is my one to Brian. It would be fantastic to fund some research going back to those villages and the areas that we looked at in the late 90s to see how population increase is impacting on land use change. If we can't do that, or that doesn't happen, are there reliable trajectories based on research from other places that we can use to tell us something about what might be happening, and once we do that, is there good evidence for what kind of interventions would help?
Can I please just add to that comment too?
Yeah, yeah.
In a similar vein, I'd like to know what kind of community consultation might be a solution to this you're presenting with.
Can you convert this into a comment?
A comment. I'd like to comment that they presented...
I'll answer your own question.
Presented a scenario in Papua New Guinea where there's this, you said it won't happen overnight. There are these big, sort of a big train going towards potential worsening of food security. I'm wondering, are there questions where community consultation at this early phase could come in, where communities can start assessing what kind of traditional knowledge they have, what kind of social systems, what kind of ideas can come from the grassroots to start addressing this and redirect this big ship at a very early stage.
Yeah, I'll make a comment. To find out what's going on in the countryside, you cannot do that without community consultation. And you have to go to an area and you have to make contact with some people and ask if you can go and look at their gardens and talk to them about what's happening. One of the things that we found out was if you get out of an aeroplane on a distant airstrip and walk off into a village and say, how are things here, what's going on? People will immediately, if it's bad, people will immediately start bitching, saying, you know, the soil's losing its fertility, we can't grow that sort of crop anymore, and they'll go on. You go to other places where things are not so bad, and after a while, when people realise that you're serious and you're going to walk up to the top of the hill or over to the next valley and have a look at certain gardens, what you try and do is you try and look at all of the gardens belonging to one family and then all of the gardens belonging to another family. While you're walking up to the gardens to have a look, while you're in the gardens, you're talking about all these sorts of issues that you just raised. What's happening at school? How are the children going to school? What's the community think about this? What's happening? And often, a couple of leading people, maybe men or even leading women, will start realising this guy knows what he's talking about and he wants to know what we know, and they'll start telling people. So in that sense of consultation, you cannot find out what's going on unless you consult with people.
Is question. I'll make a comment myself. CSIRO was doing these land surveys for how many years? Was it 30 years?
Yeah.
Did they train no one in that time? Did they build the capacity to do that in Papua New Guinea? Did no one in that time?
No, I was just looking
Why must, we be doing this, you know? Glad to hear from you, Jim. You were commenting somewhere behind you there, and I thought I'd nab you for that.
Fine. I just wanted to pick up the general issue around population growth. And again, this is something that we can be fooled. What's happened is the rate of global population growth has fallen. But of course, we're dealing with a bigger total. So when I started working in Mexico 20 odd years ago, around about 150, 160 people per minute were being added to the population of the world. And that was in the 90s, the late 90s. We still have 150 people per minute being added to the population of the world. The rate of growth has gone down, but of course you've got a greater total number to do. And in agriculture, the fact that the rate's gone down, actually, it's a little bit like your comparison you were talking about, Tom. It's even not that important, because if you've still got the same finite number of people being added, they've all got to be fed. And so I think that, you know, this whole question about taking in the importance of population growth on sustainability interventions is critical.
Follow up on?
Yeah, sure. You want to come back?
Dennis mentioned the CSIRO surveys, and there is now a national GIS for Papua New Guinea called Papua New Guinea Resource Information System. And it identifies for the whole country a whole six or eight primary attributes. So it's got things like rainfall, relief, steepness, soils. It's got a large number of attributes that can be mapped into what CSIRO called resource management units. And then Mike and I and some other people produced what we called MAST, which was Mapping Agricultural Systems Research. And we did that because the people from CSIRO came to us, John McAlpine, the late John, a great guy, a really great guy, all the best ones seem to know him. John said to us, we're really, really good at doing this resource stuff, but we can't manage agricultural systems. We just don't know how to go about it. And Mike had been doing a lot of work on agricultural systems, both in the highlands and lowlands, so he got us together and taught us how to do it. We did it for the whole country. So the two systems were, the object of the two systems was to go together. CSIRO was doing their work to see what would happen in an expanding population and increasing cash crop. So this sort of population growth rate, first of all, we don't know whether it's even across the whole country because the censuses are not good enough. Secondly, the impact will not be the same across the whole country because some places the resources are much better than others. So it's the question you were, well, the statement you were making was, can we work out where it is? Well, what? You wouldn't try and do the whole place again because it took us 5 years when we were younger and we could go up and down the hills faster. But you'd be looking at which places, where is there high population density, steep slopes, high rainfall? What's happening there? Can you go into that place for a week and find out what's going on? This idea, it's now sort of a lot disappeared, but rapid rural appraisals. Can you go to these places and do a rapid rural appraisal and see what's going on? I think you can. And in doing that, you would be, to come back to this statement over here, you would be trying to train Papua New Guineans to do that. We took a lot of Papua New Guineans into the field with us doing agricultural systems work, and some of them are still involved in agriculture. But I don't think the CSIRO was able to do this.
I just could get Bill McGee to comment on the 3 points of biosecurity approach that Tom Kappas highlighted in his presentation. Bill McGee, would you like to comment on those 3 points?
On Tom's first point about emergency response being the dominant drain on budgets, that's very true. And of course, the example of the Red Imported Fire Ant is an iconic example of the delay in finding out if you've got a pest. So what actually happened there was that because Australia has lots of ants that
bite people and hurt you. When people were getting bitten by fire ants, they went to the doctor, and the doctor quite rightly said they'd been bitten by an ant. You know, get over it. No entomologist looked at that for 10 years, I think. So there's a gap between 95 and 2002, 7 years, before they actually worked out they had red imported fire ants. So Tom's quite right. And certainly the Queensland seems to be the unlucky state that it's so hospitable to pests and diseases that they get a lot of the incursions and things like that. Then the second point about post-border surveillance is very true. Not just for specific pests, but more generalised surveillance, where you'll pick up a lot of things, forestry pests, and those sorts of questions. A lot of the money spent at the border, if we look through the history of biosecurity, there's some optics there for politicians. Sometimes, and some politicians have been very open about this, that they don't actually care what's happening at the border, as long as when you land, there's a whole mass of people there. So, you know, and some of them have been quite open about that. And often we've loaded up the border with people at the expense of the post-border surveillance or the research, which is so important as well. On the final point about the looking at the rate of return, I'd agree with Tom that, you know, we shouldn't automatically default to the benefit cost analysis. The only bit I'd add to that is that we probably underestimate, as an alternative to benefit cost analysis, to look at rate of return, the value of expert judgment. So if you've got a bunch of entomologists to talk about a particular pest, you get them together, sometimes for a relatively modest investment, you can get some enormous wisdom around what you might do about that pest. We probably used to do that a lot more when the state departments had a lot more people and scientists. But as that's got, it's harder to do that now because the people aren't there. But so that's another way. Tom mentioned looking at that rate of return. Sometimes you don't have to use a really systematic tool. You can, if you can get the right experts to do it, you can get a lot of value out of a few days with those people.
Well, I can just link the discussion back to the nexus, I suppose, in that I postulated was between food, climate change, food security, political instability, political instability, and potentially civil war. I got the sense of discussions around the table that we're not going to see a Syria, except in extreme circumstances, in the Melanesian Arc. We're not going to have millions of people emigrating to cities and then getting on boats and coming to Australia. As somebody said to me earlier, if they were going to do that, they would have done it a million years ago. So that's one point. Secondly, we haven't talked much about pre-border. And I'm just wondering, and I asked you the question earlier today, privately, Andrew, that does the priority problems identified by the Northern Australia Quarantine Service, the potential invasives to Australia, does that provide us some guideline? Maybe you can respond to this, Tom.
I'll pick up on the next point. Something I meant to say was that the obvious question is, okay, so how do we need to do policy or science differently to tackle these big intersections? And I think one of the answers is, it's a trendy term, but communities of practice. We actually, as Bill just said, get groups of technical people together that have some collective wisdom in processes that elicit that wisdom. And I think if we can look at, we don't need to restructure and rename bureaucracies all the time and have everyone's email address change consequently to deal with this. We just need smarter ways of getting networks of people working together across organisational boundaries and levels of administration and between civil society, industry and government. And I think we can do that around and outfits like the Crawford Fund and like the AAIA have a significant role to play in that regard. So I think we need to operate more like we do when there's a fire, more often in getting the right people in the room and saying how we're going to tackle this issue, and getting smarter at
pulling consortia together and then having them dissipate accordingly. We don't need to build a new institution every time this something pops up. We need institutions that can take the long view but reconfigure very quickly in response to things. So that sort of network analysis and communities of practice type process is something that I think we can work in quite well with our near neighbours. And we've got so many people from our neighbouring countries that have done postgraduate study here in Australia and that have relationships here in Australia, that I think if we actually use those networks properly, we'd be able to bring a lot more horsepower to bear on a lot of these issues more nimbly than we've done to date through quite clunky bureaucratic structures.
Just pick up 2 points.
Okay, right, quickly.
So
NACS is the well-controlled pathway, so no issue there. But of course, additional investment in northern parts of Australia could change all of this. But the first two comments are really telling for me. One of the neglected things in biosecurity is what's called passive or general surveillance. It's getting communities and community groups involved in detecting things earlier. I mean, if I'm right, if there's a lot missing post-border, one way to fill that gap is by getting communities to help with that. I think that's a wonderful thing to sort of think about and work on. It happens a bit in Australia. There are hotlines and things like that, but it's really neglected, I think, generally speaking. I feel that's something we can do more.
Yeah, oh, I agree.
And I saw Bob McMullen urging instruments to ask you a question there, but can we technology help? Because, you know, I could probably pick up on my iPhone a picture of an invasive moth if it was available on a product like PlantWise from Capio or something. Is that the way we get the community involved?
It does help, but you also get a flood of information from that as well, most of which isn't very useful. So you get a lot of false positives, but it certainly does help.
But it's possible to develop filters for those. So invasive animal CRC, you know, did a thing called rabbit scan for a cost of about $20,000, and they thought that rabbit populations were increasing in Australia, and they got a quote from CSIRO in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to do a rabbit census for update the rabbit census for Australia, and they did it through an app for $20,000. Seemed in if you've seen a rabbit, tell us if it was young or old, healthy or sick, and send us in the GPS coordinates from your phone. And then they thought, well, that can't be right, because there's an enormous amount of data came in that suggested rabbits were everywhere. And so then the experts went out, bugger me, there they are. The map was extremely accurate that they produced for $20,000, continental scale.
So technology could help.
Enormously. You know, with a good website, some sexy ads, use of social media, and a really easy free downloadable app.
John?
It's amazing what you can do.
John?
Thanks, Dennis. John Lovett, PDCRC.
Sorry,
I didn't mention this morning about the remote functional network that we've established in Indonesia. In fact, it was established first in Australia all around the coast to give people making pest and disease observations a rapid means of having them identified and determine whether we have a problem or not. So I think in terms of the research spectrum, Tom, we're actually doing what you suggest already. We do have a very strong surveillance and early warning system. We do have a post-border element. We have an impact addressing program, and we have a social one.
Are they just in Papua New Guinea or Indonesia, are you saying?
No, in CRC Mark 1, we have a program with indigenous communities in northern Australia and with village communities in Indonesia, looking at the different ways in which they address these strange pest and diseases they've never seen before.
So that's great.
And we've actually spent for 12 years now, providing tools and technologies to help people to do biosecurity better.
Mm-hmm. Bob
McDonald, you? I wanted to raise something, make a comment, I guess, rather than ask a question, of course, to Andrew. You talk about the nexus and the interrelationship between those issues, which I'm sure is a growing importance. What sort of challenge is that to the remit of ACR, which is ostensibly at least focused on just one part of that? And do we need to look at extending the remit to cover more of the elements of that nexus or do we need to set up, I don't think it's a good idea, but just to raise the options, a parallel organisation that looks at some of the others, or do we set up a separate stream within ASIA? How does the tremendous work that you've done and the reputation that you've built up lend itself to dealing with this complexity of the next?
Thanks, Bob. You've got Chatham House rules here, I presume?
No, we don't.
No, we don't.
Because we don't trust
them. In our new 10-year strategy, which I've run past the Minister's Office and the Secretary of DFAT in the last week, certainly for ACR, we see there's such a strong connection between food security and water and climate and human health and nutrition. But all of those things are firmly in scope for us, and we don't think that's an improper reading of our enabling legislation. And it's been strongly endorsed by Minister Bishop's office and also my colleague, the Secretary of DFAT. There are some boundary issues, though, that are going to be quite interesting, particularly. So what's the role of an agricultural research outfit in obesity? To me, that's a very interesting question with not a very clear answer at all. Certainly micronutrient deficiency is well and truly in scope. Zoonosis, and that part of human health and the One Health agenda is firmly in scope for us. But we can't be spread too thin. As to the second part of your question, it's not for me to comment on how the machinery of government for the Australian government evolved, but I do have a very firm view that, with the greatest respect to my colleagues in DFAT, departments of state are not well configured to run research programs long term. So I'm a strong believer in there being specific agencies that have a mandate to be research brokers and investors and managers. The agriculture portfolio is quite lucky having its R&D corporations. The environment portfolio doesn't have an equivalent of R&D corporations, and in my view, having been a former senior executive of the environment portfolio, it hasn't been a great research investor over the years. And I think the foreign affairs portfolio is extremely lucky to have a dedicated agency like ACR for the agricultural parts of the business. But I think most of us in the room would agree there isn't a great appetite for creating new institutions in this town. So that's a challenge for government, but I'm a strong view, because of the churn in the public service, because of the demands of responding to what happens in Parliament House, which is entirely proper that the bureaucracy is responsive to the Parliament, it's very difficult to have sufficient corporate memory and continuity of staff to manage a long-term research program. And the knowledge management generally within departments of state is not good enough for them to know what they funded 5 years ago, let alone 25 years ago.
He established the statutory authority when it wasn't fashionable to do so.
So I strongly believe in a dedicated professional agency to do this sort of work. And I'm comfortable that ACR scope gives us enough room to work on the core of this issue. But for example, on issues like energy, it's not at all clear what our scope to work there is, or further into the human health dimensions. I would strongly welcome DFAT having a capability to invest in health research, and we would be looking to work with that entity in the most productive way we possibly could.
Can I just follow up for a second?
Yep.
Can the same model that ACR uses, that sort of joint research model, work in all those other areas?
I believe so. That said, within our 10-year strategy, I mean, our model's overwhelmingly around what you would call applied research, to use old-fashioned language. I'm keen that we try and identify 10% of the portfolio or so where we go further upstream and look at breakthrough type research, potentially higher risk, higher reward research, where you're not measuring them by number of farmers, number of hectares, closeness to market, but you're saying if this comes off, we'll be able to tackle this problem that we haven't been able to tackle before at scale, and we're prepared to take a punt for a small part of the portfolio.
One of those be legumes and sort of soils?
Potentially, or
that you're talking about?
You know, if you look at groundwater management, the Indo-Gangetic Plain, there could be 500 million people without enough to eat within a decade or so. So Colin would know more about that than I, but there are some big things that you can see looming where incremental work is going to get us where we need to be. GM with pulses, you know, might be an example.
Jim, establishing statutory authorities when it wasn't fashionable to do so, you have some experience here, I think. And also some experience of IDRC, the Canadian Commission.
Yeah, I think old people's reminiscence is normally not very welcome. So you said it, we, with your help, and we were fortunate in that Malcolm Fraser, I shared a lot of ideas with, not at that time, late in life, but we were working on together. It's due really to the fortunate conjunction of Fraser having a genuine interest in promoting development in developing countries, and with the emphasis on scientific research activities. And of course, Sir John Crawford was the ideal person who commanded the respect of all. And we did our best. I did quite a lot myself, but and the concept is finally adopted is not really the model that Sir John Crawford offered. It's a lesser model, but I thought it was a more practical one.
Did he want the Canadian one?
He wanted the Canadian one, and I knew that. So it depends on the conjunction of circumstances at the time. And I don't know that at present time is, I can comment, is very propitious for doing anything like that.
Can I just add, Dennis, that in my previous life in land care, I often looked to the health sector for some of the models. So the health sector is very interesting. You have your paramedic type layer as well as your white lab coat layer, and you've got in some countries at least, a tremendous community outreach type capability as well. And they have the same issues of needing early warning systems and rapid diagnoses and occasional emergency response and so on. So I actually do think in a lot of the issues we're tackling, there are some very significant synergies between health and agriculture. And we'd be silly to set up silos, and I actually am an admirer of the Canadian model, and we're doing we're doing a lot with IDRC in direct partnership, and we're going to be doing more.
Can I just add something to Bob's question and Andrew's response, and it's just a small anecdote. That project that was in the Australian International Food Security Centre in Africa on poultry, the impact of poultry on livelihoods. And through partnership with a health professionals, researchers, the researcher Robin was able to look at the not only the impacts, you know, of nutrition on children, etc., but the humans that had children and the women particularly had blood samples taken and other samples taken that you could actually get a definitive answer of what, you know, having poultry meat and eggs. In, as well as the effects on soil fertility of that.
They were even able to measure increases in cognitive ability of the kids, weren't they?
Yes, I think that's correct. Yeah. So I'm just giving it as an anecdote that, you know, how you can add value to something that was a valuable project anyway.
Okay.
went down the nexus.
So there's a question to Andrew with a comment. I'm wondering whether you're intending to move ACR to be more flexible and bureaucratic. I'll tell you what drives that comment. Back in middle of 2015, it looked like Papua New Guinea and the rest of the region was heading for a drought very similar to 97. In fact, it was. It wasn't in the event, it wasn't quite as big, but it was that order of magnitude. I rang up a number of people, deputy, third deputy, but also Richard Markham. Finally got through to Richard in Samoa and said, listen, mate, this is big. You're really, this is a once in a generation. The last time this happened was 1997, 18 years ago. Time before that was 1941. There's big issues with sweet potato weevil. You've got 5 million out of DFAT for that, for a project and pipeline. There's big issues with sweet potato tuberization, flagged by Matt Canoa and Sergi Bang, but we don't understand it. But we know when the rains come, the yields actually crash. Everything else goes up, sweet potato goes down. It's too much nitrogen. It's to do with the bugs and water and nitrogen interaction. There were insect issues, which became big, but particularly on the human side, my judgment of ACR, which I admire greatly, is that your best returns will be on the social stuff as much as on the technical. The human response to these events, how people react and everything, we understand least of all. I put that to Richard. He said, Mike, believe everything you're saying. Don't argue with any of it, but we're a bureaucracy. We can't move that quickly. I talked to DFAT at Post in Moresby and said, well, you guys have just given $26 million to ACR. Could you swing $1 million to ACR, let them use $1 million on this developing emergency and top it up in 5 years' time? I said, yeah, I don't see why not. You know, it's a $26 million over 5 years. Why don't we just move it back? That's all doable. Now, that person can't speak, but DFAT, pretty well senior person. But when I put it to Richard, he said, no, Mike, we're a bureaucracy, can't do it. And I was very disappointed in that.
Oh, so am I, Mike. I can give a more recent example with wheat blast emerging in Bangladesh, and we were able to mobilise resources very quickly, and we were the first donor in there to help the Bangladeshis get on, get their heads around what's, or at least trying to work out an immediate response.
Jim?
Well, since you asked me before, I'm speaking on my own accord this time, but it's a question, unfortunately.
Okay.
It's addressed to Dr. Allen. I thought his analysis of the shifting cultivation system in PNG, the fact that people are sufficiently fed so far, but, and it's obviously a very sustainable approach to food production, but you concluded by saying that with the increase in population, remained an open question as to whether there wouldn't be malnutrition in the near future. But my question is, there have been so many of these shifting cultivation societies in Southeast Asia and Latin America, which, you know, I'm not an expert at this, but I would be interested to know whether the history of what has happened to shifting cultivation elsewhere is relevant to how change, because obviously changes do need to be introduced, how the process could be helped. That's the question.
Yes, I mean, just before you answer that, I'm going to ask you, Tim, because you were involved in a project, Margarini Land Settlement Scheme in East Africa, which sought to replace the shifting agricultural scheme with a settlement scheme with a sort of integrated agricultural system. What was your experience there? It's relevant to Jim's question.
Yes. The challenges are extremely high because you're not just talking about technical interventions, you're talking about major social change and attitudes, major changes in land holding, etc. And to think that those could all be brought together in what at the time I think was a 10-year project, you know, was ambitious.
I was one of the designers of this project,
yeah.
I have to confess.
Having said that, the you really have to deal with, the research is critical. You've got to deal with facts. And we were able to establish some facts in those early times that Bryant and others were able to analyse later on, you know, about the relationships between yield, rainfall, how much land you would need, what plot size should be, how that would vary between the rainfall bands, how it would vary between the soil types on the project, etc., etc. And so the it's great to have that overview, and the project has a very good it was a very good framework. But when you get down to the detail, the sort of stuff we're talking about, a bit like Brian was saying, that these impacts he's talking about of shifting agriculture and the times of it will be different from region to region. And that's really what we found at MAGA region.
Yep.
Yep.
And the Southeast Asian experience appears to be that people are moving off the land. Yeah, they're getting jobs in towns. They're finding employment locally in rural. There's rural employment. At the moment, in many parts of Papua New Guinea, that's not appearing. And the question was asked earlier this morning. I paraphrase it, how do you get them off the farm? And I think it's a very important question. At the moment, unless somebody else can suggest something, I can't see Papua New Guineans or Solomon Islanders getting off the farm and feeding themselves. They are moving, and they're not necessarily moving from their rural location into the towns. Many of them are moving from a rural location to a peri-urban area. So, for example, a lot of people have moved onto the road that runs from Port Moresby north-west towards Mekio, up that way, and they're living, they're squatting and renting and whatever on land there because they can grow their own food, they can get access to the market, they can send their kids to school, they can get to the hospital, whereas back where they come from, they can't do any of those things. So that's the move that's taking place at the moment, not necessarily in the urban areas. But then they're still rural, they're still subsisting.
So there are no agricultural lessons. Movement of people off the land.
What appears to be happening in Asia is that there are local enterprises starting up, entrepreneurs are starting up businesses, bicycle shops or...
But they're not changing their cultivation methods. They're expanding rice production, say, and terraces and irrigation.
They've clearly done that in some places. They've clearly done that in the Philippines, all those terraces, Java. But that appears that what happened in Java was under Dutch colonial pressure to intensify.
There's certainly some good examples in Latin America, particularly in Central America, of adjustments to the shifting agricultural scheme and of making it more robust by managing the remnant vegetation and not just totally clearing it, pruning, zero cultivation, so it's a conservation agriculture system, and maintaining soil cover.
And bringing in some fertilizer, I think, in some of those.
And a range of crops. So
planting trees rather than leaving the natural cycle to come back, deliberately planting trees.
And it's more productive, but importantly, more resilient to particularly root spring climatic events.
And we're seeing that with the Trees for Food Security project in Africa, too.
Yeah.
East Africa.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've
had a floor. Thank you. My comment comes from a very different perspective because it's an interdisciplinary meeting, so allow me to ask a question, make a comment. Especially to Dr. Bryant, I was very impressed by your presentation. And one of the important premises seemed to be that there will be a doubling in the size of population every 30 years. This is the premise from which you make your calculations at the moment. So I wonder whether we can bring in here another perspective and experiences from other parts of the world, other regions of the world, where the improvement in fertility of the soil and agricultural patterns and so on have been complemented with family planning, of course, on the one hand, but especially with education of girls and women in order to slow down this population growth, which of course has an important impact on the culture and on maybe religious questions, certainly society, social, economic, and political question. So how is this topic addressed interdisciplinarily by the cooperation which we are looking at here? Or is this, are these models important?
Yes, they are important. I didn't make the point that women in rural Papua New Guinea are screaming out for family planning help. They want to control their fertility. But I would also point out that the Australian aid program was completely hamstrung by some senator in Tasmania who didn't like birth control. So it wasn't allowed to have any birth control in any of its aid programs. Now, that was a long time ago. It wasn't that long ago.
But I think the great wheel of history is passed you on.
But, you know, it was changed in 2009.
There are possibilities of getting what are these, not injections, but implants, yes. Some part, things are so uneven in Papua New Guinea. In some places, the health system works because there's a nurse there who's doing it, she's going out and seeking the stuff, giving it to the women. Other places, not happening at all. But women everywhere are saying, I don't want to get pregnant again.
But can population, is population growth something which is important for the society,
no.
Or is it? Is
not
education of women and girls, does it have a positive impact also on lowering fertility rates?
I think it does, yes. The answer is yes. And yes, education of women is very, very important. Educated women are much less likely to have malnourished children.
Tristan.
I just want to bring together a couple of threads that are going on here in the room and make a comment about those, and then I want to disagree with you, Dennis, just because I enjoy doing that.
Yeah.
The first is to say that...
I've not even done it for 30 years.
The first is to say that, I guess, looking at what's going on in Melanesia and trying to understand what might happen by looking at the experience in Asia and other countries, I actually don't think is very useful, because I actually think that the culture and the land tenure systems are fundamentally different, and I think if you look at how things have transformed in Southeast Asia, for example, how people have interacted with the landscape at a national and a subnational level, you're not going to see a trajectory like that in Solomon Islands, where I lived for a number of years. People, the nation in Melanesia, as we all know, is very different from the nation in most other parts of the world. So I think that's just, I think that we're in, to some degree, with a 3% population growth rate, we are in uncharted waters. And I think anything could happen. And this touches on the very important comment that was just made by, sorry, I don't know your name, around empowerment of women and girls in education and empowerment of women to have some sort of control over their fertility. And if we look at in Asia, where we're seeing declining birth rates, that's really strongly correlated with economic opportunities that are not actually happening to the same degree in Melanesia. So I think these are fundamentally different systems and they need fundamentally different responses. That's my comment. Secondly, I guess just related to that, you know, I think there is a possibility. I don't think we're going to be dealing with Assyria, but I think that, Dennis was saying, look, this isn't, you know, there's not going to be a big possibility of big migration, of big disruption. And I would say that, you know, within the next 30 to 50 years, I suspect that there may be, because you're going to have these very, potentially very dislocated populations of people who can no longer be supported by their family plots, who are drifting into population centres that are very, very poorly serviced, or not serviced at all, in the case of Honiara and the outskirts of Honiara, that I know well. And there are all sorts of cultural dimensions there that are also different to if we compare them to other countries in the region. So I'm just putting it out there.
You're disagreeing with me. I was making an observation on what someone else had said during the day. Actually, you, Ashton made that comment. So would you like to respond to that? Because it seems, well, first of all, I mean, I think it's a little bit condescending for us to say the Melanesians won't be able to do this.
I wasn't saying that.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you were. But Ashton, would you like to respond to that, the point about the potential for migration?
Yeah.
Stereotype. I mean, you know, clearly the Islam is not an issue in Papua New Guinea, but maybe in Eastern Indonesia it is.
Look, I think that...
Ashton was Assistant Director General of ONA.
Yeah, look, as I think I mentioned in my earlier remarks, I ran a bit perplexed by the lack of momentum for immigration, both across the Melanesian arc, fully described, into sort of eastern Indonesia, and to points further south. In fact, rather the opposite, that we've actually got, particularly say in the French end of the arc, immigration into New Caledonia from elsewhere in the French Pacific rather than the other way out, even though the opportunities are actually there. I think that all of the indicators of growth and the environmental pressure that comes with growth, one keeps working through this, which has surely got to give us a security problem further down the track. I think that I was particularly taken by the comments that many people have thought we've got a huge safety net in Papua New Guinea by virtue of a seemingly larger amount of accessible agricultural land proportionate to even a growing population in the country. And I think the discussion earlier that that's actually a very false assumption. That the capacity for agricultural expansion in Papua New Guinea is actually extremely limited, it gives, I think, very strong pause for thought. I find it very hard to sort of see that taking Papua New Guinea as the one example, that we're actually going to look at a major national scale disruptive security consequence of either population growth or environmental damage. I think that the issue of fragmentation is conceivably something that is more realistic. I think the first cap off the rank is likely to be where we actually go with Bougainville when we come around to the next referendum issue there, which I think PNG is poorly prepared. But again, I think that even if one has a diminution of central authority over outer regions, does that necessarily give you a major security problem? A country like the Philippines, I think, has seen a devolution of effective power to many of the provincial areas without necessarily either giving a national scale security emergency, leaving aside the problems in Mindanao, or actually disrupting the continued existence of the state. One of the analogies that I've sort of seen used with Papua New Guinea has been that in understanding how Papua New Guinea works, it's best to look at a Walpolean British Parliament. That is to say that what you've actually got is at least a group of seniors in the country, regionally based, who recognise there's a continuing common interest in maintaining the fabric of the PNG state, at least the very basic level. And I don't see anything that's going to actually seriously challenge that basic calculation among many of the folk up there. So I guess to come back to Dennis's point, I think we're well short of a cathartic security situation out of the sorts of pressures that have been discussed here this afternoon that would give us civil war or that. It's very hard to run a civil war in PNG because to shoot someone you have to be able to get in touch with them. And I think that the continued issue of poor land communications, I'm leaving aside sort of the possibility of regionalised disturbances, but on a national scale, I just don't think we're anywhere near that at this point. So, and I also, lastly I say is, I hesitate simply to sign up to the prolonged, benign, neglect approach to sort of, to PNG's problems in this area, but I think that, I think we're well short of the complete failure of the PNG state. But rather, I think, a trajectory of continuing declining services and...
Might that include quarantine services, Bill McGee?
I suppose...
And what impact would that have on us?
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, if I think back with New Guinea, a few disasters were averted because they actually rang us one-on-one because we trained them in Australia. But I hear there's a lot of turnover in their quarantine service. So if you lose those sort of direct contacts, yes.
But that's where I mentioned institution building.
Yeah.
We just had a recent instance where we had major concerns about the National Fisheries Authority in PNG around basics like project management, budgeting, you know, planning and so on. So we put an entire cohort of bureaucrats, several layers of them, through a graduate diploma at the University of Tasmania run in PNG. They graduated on Monday with their mortar boards and their gowns and as proud as punch. And so we you know, did it at an institutional level to upgrade a whole agency in one go. And I can see, for less than the cost of one PhD scholarship.
Yeah.
So I can see us doing a lot more of that in targeted ways in areas where we identify potential risks.
Yeah.
Okay, well, last comment for the day, for the afternoon.
Yes,
for the afternoon
take a very quick one. I may be the one that said climate refugees in the discussion. For information, Kiribati has already bought about 5,000 acres of land in Fiji to move the people once the situation gets bad. I mean, if those of you who have been to Kiribati or Tuvalu, it doesn't matter, actually understand what's happening on the ground. I don't think I said climate refugee in the context of the MSGR, but the Pacific. And I don't think we're talking about tomorrow. We're talking about in time to come when the full impact of 1.2 or 1.5 or 1.2 degree increase in temperature. So the reality is that there's already a movement at this moment.
And I've seen an analysis by Geoscience Australia that for small island states, you know, you have freshwater, groundwater lenses, but when the seawater pressure gets to a certain point, and you don't actually have to have the sea level above ground before people have to leave once you haven't got any fresh water.
Brian, last comment.
You're on.
Before you go to afternoon tea, I just wanted you to feel secure in the knowledge that Australia's northern borders are guarded by pigs. There are a number of pigs, I don't know what their names are, but they're called sentinel pigs, and they're in Gulf Province and Western Province and Torres Strait. And every now and again, they give it a little bit of blood, and somebody has a look at that blood to see whether their antibodies are positive to an arborea virus or other that's coming down from Asia with the birds.
Pigs and flies.
So the pigs are there, and there's flies as well.
I think that's a good point to finish on. Thank you all very much. Thank you for coming. Okay, afternoon tea time. We resume at